Chapter 27, verse 1 says, "And David said in his heart, I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul." And as we read through these seven verses, take note, David is in a minor key. These are not the tones and the melodies and the lyrics we're used to hearing from this psalmist. David said in his heart, "I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape into the land of the Philistines. And Saul shall despair of me to seek me any more in the coast of Israel. So shall I escape out of his hand." And David arose, and he passed over with 600 men that were with him unto Achish, the son of Maach, king of Gath. And David went with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's wife, his widow. And it was told Saul that David was fled to Gath, and he sought no more again for him. And David said unto Achish, "If I have now found grace in thine eyes, let them give me a place in some town in the country, that I may dwell there. For why should I, thy servant, dwell in the royal city with thee?" And then Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Wherefore Ziklag pertaineth unto the kings of Judah unto this day. And the time that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was a full year and 4 months, 16 months in enemy territory. We come to a place now, or as we listen to David, David is in a place where he is completely discouraged. He has come to that place where he just wants to throw the baby out with the bathwater. He just wants to heave everything out the window. He wants to throw up his hands. He just wants to quit. He's done. He's fried. He's frazzled. Not trying anymore. Something you've never experienced, but for some reason the Bible tells us about these kinds of things. John Bunyan wrote Pilgrim's Progress in his third prison term, and for 12 years in prison. And it's been translated in over 100 languages, and who knows how many people have been affected by it. But he tells about his main character, Christian, on his journey to the kingdom, coming to a place called the Slough of Despond. And he gets caught in this deep, miry bog. Despondency, despair, discouragement. And one comes along named Help. Helper, a picture of the Holy Spirit. And Help lifts him out of the Slough of Despond. And Christian says to him, "Why this Slough of Despond? Can't there be a bridge? Can't there be a road around? Isn't on the pathway to the kingdom, isn't this avoidable in some way? Can't we get past this place?" And the answer to his question from Help is this: "This miry slough is such a place as cannot be mended. This miry slough is such a place as cannot be mended." God has brought David to the Slough of Despond. And the thing that we have to see as we look at this, what is the lesson? In the Bible never prohibits us from being discouraged or depressed. It's when we come to that fork in the road, the lesson is, what decision do we make in that condition? What do we do? How do we relate? Where do we go? Discouragement is part of the anvil that God is using in the life of David. We're watching David. We understand why he's discouraged. I mean, even before Goliath, this guy has a right to be discouraged. He's the youngest of eight brothers. Imagine being there in the pecking order. When Samuel's looking for a leader, they don't even bother to call him, his dad or his brother. Don't even think of him. That's where he's at in the pecking order. I'd be depressed right there. And then after a great victory with Goliath, we've gone through this week after week. Position stripped away, wife stripped away, family stripped away, Samuel stripped away, best friend stripped away. Adullam, broken, looking up, looking to God. And then thinking, this is it, Lord, okay, I'm learning the lesson. Well, then you go to Keilah. And you're handed over by the people you protect. And then you meet the Ziphites, who deliberately betray you. And then Saul chasing you around the mountain. And then finding him in a cave and being able to take his life and sparing his life using great restraint. Samuel dies. He encounters Nabal. And then Saul is out looking for him again with 3,000 men at this point to kill him. I understand why David is discouraged. That's not the problem. I would be discouraged long before this. You know, I have people come to me sometimes and say, I'm discouraged. I'm depressed. Well, what do you mean? Well, I just am struggling. I don't know what the Lord wants me to do. I have this heavy feeling. And I say, well, are you talking about suicide? No, not that. I'm just discouraged. What do you think I should do? Be discouraged. Be depressed. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, God wired us. We look at David, and he has this capacity for tremendous highs. Well, the other side of that coin is that's a person also has capacity for tremendous lows. Some of us are very pragmatic and move forward like this, but there's people like Peter, who their greatness is in the greatness of their humanity, and God uses that. They have ability for tremendous eyes, but they resonate at that low place, too. And that's okay. That's not a problem. Spurgeon was a man like that. And he said he was tortured every Saturday night trying to get ready for Sunday morning. He would go in fits of depression for months. It isn't the problem. It's not how do we remove this place called discouragement. Can we build a bridge here? How do we get away from the slough of despond? No, David, haven't you noticed your life has gone furnace to the anvil, furnace to the anvil, furnace to the anvil. God is hammering you into the man and into the woman that he wants all of you to be. And he's sovereign to use those circumstances. The problem is when we get to that place, it isn't avoiding it. It's what decision do we make there? How do we respond at that fork in the road in that place called discouragement? It's part of God's will, part of His plan. There's a folk story about the devil having a sail, all of his tools, laid out on a table, displayed with price tags on them. And of course, there was hatred, murder, drunkenness, malice, immorality, all that you'd expect to see there, his tools. And the story says that over in the corner, there was an unrecognizable, dusty, old piece. And it wasn't until you went over to it that you saw the label said discouragement, and it had the highest price of everything that was there. And the question was asked of the devil, why the price? And he said, well, what makes it valuable to me is it is unrecognizable. I can begin to use it in someone's life before they know it. And it's the one tool that opens the door for me to use all of the other tools. Discouragement. Because it's from there they go back to the bar. It's from there they turn to another man or another woman. It's from there they turn to hatred, to frustration, to malice. And David is at a point of discouragement at this place in his life. He cries out some of these things that are associated by scholars with this time. Not heading into the period. He ends up in enemy territory for 16 months. He doesn't say a prayer or write a psalm there. But at this low point before he moves, he will cry out, why standest thou afar off, O Lord? Why hidest thou thyself in times of trouble? Imagine that from David. Again, at this time, he would say in Psalm 13, how long wilt thou forget me? You ever feel that way? O Lord, forever? How long wilt thou hide thy face from me? And of course, one of the most famous psalms associated with this time, "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me and from the words of my roaring?" The great prophecy of the suffering of the Messiah. David is making many cries that we understand, that we've cried internally ourselves. But he makes three mistakes at this point in time, and they're outlined for us here, and then they set a course. Then there's what Jeff calls a flow chart. I like that. First thing it says is David said in his heart. First mistake. When you're discouraged, David talks about his heart being overwhelmed. Why seek counsel from a heart that's overwhelmed? Why go to the place that's desperately wicked and incurable? Why go to human reason? That's the thing that fails us the most at a time like that. When everything seems to be falling apart, when the pressure is unimaginable, when we want to throw in the towel, when we're thinking of the most unthinkable things, to then try to reason with human reason, you know, that's when we say, well, why do you think he's doing this? And do you think God's doing this because of this? And you think he's inhabited because of this? And you think if I'd have done this, he'd have done that? And you think that he wants me to learn this? And you end up in the paralysis of analysis. You end up in that bog. You end up in the slough of despond. There's no way out of that. Human reason is not what's necessary. David should be falling on his knees at this point in time and crying out to God. And he's not. The first thing he does is he begins to reason this back and forth in his own wisdom, human rationale, trying to ask questions that are much bigger than the circumstances. Second thing he does, and I think it's wrong, is he says this, "I shall now perish by the hand of Saul." That's where you end up with human reason. You know, the truth is, he's never been closer to Saul's death and his ascending the throne. That's the truth of where he stands. That truth has been communicated to him. Samuel has anointed him and told him, "You're going to sit on the throne of Israel." Jonathan, Saul's son, has come and said, "David, I know God's going to establish your heart, your house. You're going to be the king." Saul himself has said to David, "You're going to be the king of Israel. The kingdom's going to be established," and it had never been. "It's going to be established under your hand." Abigail, "God's going to establish you, David, as the king of Israel. And more than that, your life is bound in a bundle of life with the Lord." David's forgotten all of those things. And he's got himself into that frame of mind where everything is wrong. I heard Charles Swindoll talk about a medical doctor wrote a book. It's called How to Live 365 Days a Year. And in the book, he cites this farmer who lived in the town where he grew up. His name was Sam. And he said, Sam looked at everything on the negative side. He said, "I talked to his wife. They've been married 40 years and said, has Sam ever said a positive thing?" She said, "I think in the first year of our marriage, he said one positive thing, but I can't remember what it was." He said, "I went out to the farm and Sam's oats were ready to be harvested." He said, "It was the finest crop of oats I'd ever seen." And I said, "Sam, this is the 300 some acres of oats. This is the best looking harvest of oats, best looking crop I've seen in years." He said, Sam said, "Yeah, well, the wind will probably blow them down before I get them in." So he came back a few weeks later. They were in the barn. And I said, and then, you know, before he went through the whole process of separating, you know, and he said, Sam said, "Well, they'll probably catch on fire before I get them to market." He ended up getting the market and got the best price he'd ever gotten for a harvest of oats. And he said, "I said, Sam, I heard you got a great price for that yield." He said, "Yeah, but a yield like that takes a lot out of the ground." He said, "I saw him with one of the best yields of corn, 167 bushels per acre I ever saw, and just talked to him. It was remarkable." And he said, "Yeah, but that's heavy. Where's the machinery? That's a lot of weight." He said, "I saw him in a beautiful day late in the autumn before the snows came, and it was just beautiful, warmed up the trees." I said, walking by, I said, "Sam, ain't this a beautiful day for late in the fall?" And he said, "Yeah, but when we get it, we're really going to get it." You know, And some people, you know, here's David, and he's saying, I'm surely going to die by the hand of Saul. You know what I like about that? This is a guy who's already written, the Lord is my light and my salvation, in whom I shall trust, of whom shall I be afraid? He's already written, there's one thing I've desired of the Lord, that will I seek after, I dwell in the house of the Lord, days of my life. He's already written, Lord, you are my rock and my fortress. He's already written Psalms and has forgotten about them. That's encouraging to me. Because I may teach the word and forget about it, but at least I didn't write it and forget about it. And you know, as believers, we get to that place. We can be so overwhelmed, we can forget what we know. And the bothersome thing is, if we want to be honest, is that we do know. Satan may have his tools laying out on the table, but God has his tools laying out on the table in plain sight too. He's given us his word. He's given us his spirit. He's given us his son. He's given us his grace. We almost wish that there was a secret to all this. You see, if we were willing to buy a book that says the secret of victory, the secret of happiness, the secret of joy, because then we can be miserable with an excuse, because we don't know the secret. What really should bother us is we do know the secret. And it's so simple, we should be convicted about it. We have the answer. We have the truth of God's word. David, at this point, is refusing to remember the promises of God. And Peter tells us that we have been partakers of the divine nature by great and precious promises and have been born again to a living hope by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. But when you start to use human reason, then you push aside the divine will, God's word. And the third step is this, it says he passed over. Stepped back into enemy territory. Went to Philistine country. You know, he goes to Gath. Well, the best thing Gath ever produced was Goliath. The most powerful thing that Gath ever spit out was that giant, and David killed him when he was 15 years old. Now he's going to Gath. And we think when we come to that place and discouraged, we're angry at God. Oh God, David says, you've cast me off. How long is it going to be? How long are you going to forget me? Forever? Huh? Forever? Ha ha ha. You can do that. You're God. People can forget for a while. You can forget forever. I bet that's what you're going to do, ain't you? You know how you don't ever get that frame of mind, but David gets there. And then it crosses into enemy territory. He steps over the line. And you know, we think we can do that without influencing other people. We could think that we can do that and get away with it. We think we'll just go there for a day. I could just sit down and have a cold one. I could just slug this guy. I could just curse at him, I'll feel better. I'm tired of fighting the fight. I'm tired of hanging in. I'm tired of laying down my life. I'm tired of taking up my cross. I want to freak out. It'll be so much easier. But the problem is, when we cross the line for a day, the day leads to the next day, and the days lead to weeks, and the weeks lead to months, and the months lead to years. And for a year and a half, he's in enemy territory. That takes 600 men with him, and their wives, and their children. He led them all there. He ends up with the wrong kind of grace and the wrong master. Says in verse 5 to Achish, now if I've found grace in your sight. Well, David, what about finding grace in the eyes of the Lord? Now you're finding grace in the eyes of Achish? Then he says to Achish, let thy servant, David, you got the wrong master. Achish is your master now? And that's what happens when we cross over. We end up in the wrong place. And yeah, there can be relief temporarily. It says Saul stopped chasing him at that point. And there is pleasures of sin for a season. Sometimes it seems like the day we cross over, we throw in the towel, we give up. Ah, it's so much better. I can't believe I was so stupid, trying. The pressure is off. Well, Satan knows how to do that, you understand. You remember Jesus, when he was at the wedding at Cana, that turned the water into wine. And the steward of the feast said this, and it gives us a great picture of the way the world operates. The steward of the feast said, you know, normally at these shindigs, they put out the good wine first, and when everybody's half pickled, they put out the poison. Because then they don't care. They're already soused. He said, but at this wedding, you've saved the best for last. And that, in my mind, sets up the contrast between the way the world works and the way Jesus works. The world puts out the best up front. That's where the bait is. That's where the relief of the pressure is. That's where, you know, do this. Have it now. Satisfy your longing or your lust or your anger, whatever it is now. And then when we're intoxicated with that is when the poison comes of it all. Whereas Jesus, yeah, we may wrestle now. Our kids may be sick. There may be difficulties. We may have to put up with noisy neighbors or, you know, discouragement or, but we're going to a place where there's no sorrow, there's no tears, where he wipes away the tears from our eyes, there's no death, there's no curse, there's no sighing. We're going to a place that's unimaginable, and he saved the best for last. You know, when we come here and have a communion service, it's probably one of my favorite times to be here. Everybody's singing and carrying on and crying and worshiping. And I'm thinking, Lord, if you just lift the building up into heaven right now, if just a few cherubim, Lord, and a throne in the middle would make it all complete here. But then I remember, well, we ain't seen nothing yet because he saved the best for last. And David has forgotten about the promises of God at this point in time, which should be an anchor to our song. He gets involved, it tells us as we read down, and I don't have time, so I'll just go through this. He starts fighting with the Gershurites and the Gezerites, and maybe because of their names he just wanted to kill them, I don't know. It just gives us this list. He fights, and these are kind of enemies of Israel, but this is borderline stuff. You know, he's doing this borderline spiritual stuff. And backsliders do that. They do like these little spiritual, you know, appeasers, you know, to prove that they still have some spiritual life left in them. Achish comes and says, have you been raiding today? And David says, oh, these guys and those guys. He lies to Achish. He's lying. And it says when he goes on those raids, he kills every man, woman, and child, and cattle, and everything. Doesn't leave any eyewitnesses because he doesn't want Achish to know where he's at. Even though they're the enemies of God. So that's the way a backslider always is. They are ruthless when it comes to covering their own tracks and shifting the blame somewhere else. And being blameless themselves. And it's sad because he took the step in this direction to be relieved from pressure, but now as time goes on, the pressure is building and building and building to much greater degrees than he ever experienced it when he was buckling his knees under the pressure of God. He's lying now. He's fighting now. He's getting involved in all of these insane situations. Until chapter 30, verse 1, it tells us there that David got in a pickle because the Philistines decide to go to battle with Israel. Now what do you do? Because Achish thinks David's his buddy. He's Saul's enemy. Certainly he's going to go to battle with us against Israel. You know how when you get out back out in the watering hole or you get out somewhere and they're making fun of Christians, they expect you to be on their side. So David reluctantly begins to go to battle, and the other lords of the Philistines show more sense. They say to Achish, this is the guy that slaughtered 10,000. Remember the song? What are you bringing him behind us for? He's going to ambush us in battle. And Achish says, well, I know I can trust David. I feel you guys don't feel the same way. And he goes to David and says, David, do me a favor. These guys are fussy. They don't trust you like I do. Just go back to Ziklag and cool it. We'll fight the battle. Well, it's 3 days it takes David to get back to Ziklag. When he gets back to Ziklag, he finds it smoldering in ruins. The wives are gone, the children are gone, everything's gone, and the very place in enemy territory that he thought would be a stronghold and a place of rest has become the very place where he's lost his wife and he's lost his children. And whenever we step away from God and we cross into enemy territory and we start to lead a life of compromise and it involves lying and covering up our tracks, and we're fleeing, you know, the stronghold of the Lord to live in enemy territory, it's always the family that becomes the casualty. And then finally it tells us in chapter 30, verse 6, that his men, his 600 men, the guys he trained in Adullam, take up stones to kill him. They want to stone David. You brought us down here. It's your fault our wives and our kids are gone. And then you know what it says? Finally, it says, David then fell on his knees and encouraged, that's the word we've been waiting for, encouraged himself in the Lord his God. David fell on his knees and he encouraged himself in the Lord his God. Now, by the way, they recover all of the wives, all of the kids, everything. The problem is this. That verse, David encouraged himself in the Lord his God, should not be written in chapter 30, verse 6. It should be written in chapter 27, verse 1. And it isn't that it's two chapters later, it's 16 months later. We can cover it in one morning in a Bible study. But this is 16 months of being away from the Lord. And David at that point, it says, falls on his knees and he encourages himself in the Lord is God. That's when things begin to turn around. That was the other fork in the road that was there right in chapter 27, verse 1, when he was in the slough of despond. He was able to look up and helper would be there to take his hand and to lift him out. And he had turned away. Now look, I don't know, obviously, where everybody is in their own hearts this morning. If you're having a great time with the Lord right now, you can record this lesson under and put it in capital letters on your file. I will need you in the future. Because you will. If you are completely discouraged this morning, you know who you are. There's a fork in the road at that point. You can take and apply human reason to the circumstance, setting your own opinion on a higher plane than the Word of God, and in that turning away from His promises. It will lead you in a path that crosses over a line where you take things to yourself out of the divine hand, as it were. Or you can fall on your knees, at least in your heart, where you are, and say, Lord, I'm in the slough of despond. You've got me on this anvil. If I'd have known this was going to be the sermon this morning, I'd have stayed home and been miserable. But here I am. Be my helper, the one who never leaves me or forsakes me. Reach down to me, Lord. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, Lord, because you are there with me. I'm going to have the musicians come.